Mr. Chairman and friends. It's now, as I think most of you know, about a month since we stepped down into what we may describe as the current, as the mighty river, the mighty stream of the Bodhisattva ideal. And each week as we've come here, we've gone, or we've tried to go, just a little deeper into that river, into that current, into that stream. And by this time, I think we can feel that we find ourselves more or less right in the middle of that stream. Not only find ourselves in the middle of it, but find ourselves, feel ourselves being borne along by it more and more rapidly. Perhaps at first we might have struggled a little against the current. We might not have been altogether happy about being borne along, but perhaps now we are not struggling, not resisting anymore, but just allowing ourselves to be borne, as it were, in the direction of the ocean. That is to say, in the direction of what we call enlightenment, nirvana, Buddhahood, and so on. Now, in the course of these last 4 weeks, we have travelled quite a distance. We've left behind, perhaps, quite a number of old familiar landmarks. We've passed through quite a lot of unfamiliar country, unfamiliar terrain. We've seen, perhaps, to continue the metaphor, have seen, as we were swept along this river, have seen dense forests, have seen, perhaps in the distance, lofty mountain peaks. In other words, we've seen, as we've been carried along week by week, different aspects of the Bodhisattva ideal. In the course of the first week, in the course of the first week's lecture, we saw that the Bodhisattva was the ideal Buddhist, one who lives for the sake of enlightenment, enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. We saw further that the Bodhisattva is the living embodiment of both wisdom and compassion, that he is inspired in his life, in his activity, in his work, not only by what the Buddha said, not only by the verbal teaching of the Buddha, but also by what the Buddha in his intrinsic being was and what he did, the sort of influence he radiated upon other men and other women. In the course of the second week's lecture, we saw that one becomes a bodhisattva, one becomes a being dedicated to enlightenment for the benefit of all by the arising of what is called the bodhicitta. Literally, this means, as we saw, the thought of enlightenment. But we also saw that the bodhicitta is much more than the thought of enlightenment in the sense of an idea or a concept of or about enlightenment. We saw that it's a sort of spiritual force, a spiritual power, if you like, at work in the universe. We saw that it is something transcendental, something above and beyond this world in its ultimate essence. We saw that it is not, in fact, individual at all, but universal, that there is one bodhicitta, one will to enlightenment, and that individual bodhisattvas participate in this in varying degrees. We also saw that the bodhicitta arises in dependence on certain conditions, and these conditions are represented by Shantideva's supreme worship and Vasubandhu's four factors. Now, in our third week's lecture, we saw that whereas the bodhicitta itself is universal, the individual bodhisattva is an individual, a person. And the bodhicitta therefore expresses itself in his life and in his work in a thoroughly individual manner. And this individual expression of the bodhicitta through the individual bodhisattva is what we call the bodhisattva's vow. And though we speak of the vow in the singular rather than in the plural, it is in fact, we saw, really plural. And there are a number of famous sets of vows which illustrate the nature of the bodhisattva's vow. The most famous set is, of course, that of the four great vows, wherein the bodhisattva gives expression to the aspiration, the fourfold aspiration: may I deliver all beings from difficulties, may I eradicate all passions, may I master all dharmas, and may I lead all beings to Buddhahood. Now, last week we dealt with altruism and individualism in the spiritual life. And we saw that the bodhisattva himself represents, or the bodhisattva ideal itself represents, a living union of opposites. We saw that the bodhisattva ideal synthesizes the mundane and the transcendental, samsara and nirvana, wisdom and compassion. We saw further that it does not represent, the bodhisattva ideal does not represent altruism as opposed to individualism, that we saw that the bodhisattva is not concerned with the salvation of others as opposed to his own salvation. This, we saw, is a popular misrepresentation. These expressions should not be taken literally. The bodhisattva does, in fact, embody both altruism and individualism. The altruistic aspect of the bodhisattva ideal is represented by dana, or giving, the first of the paramitas, the perfections or transcendental virtues, whereas the individualistic aspect is represented by sila, or uprightness, which is the second paramita. We saw, by the way, incidentally, that the practice of the paramitas, the perfections, the transcendental virtues, represents what is known as the establishment aspect of the bodhicitta. Now, last week we dealt with this question of dana, or giving, the first of the paramitas, along traditional lines. And we saw, you may recollect, to whom one could give, at what one could give, how one should give, and why. In the case of sila, the second paramita, we adopted a rather different procedure. We took traditional categories like the five precepts for granted, and we examined the Buddha's attitude towards such things as food, work, and marriage. So in this way, week by week, we have seen quite a lot as we've allowed ourselves to be borne along by the current of the bodhisattva ideal. And today, we're going to see just a little more. Today, we're concerned with another pair of opposites, a very important pair of opposites, and we're concerned with the way in which the bodhisattva synthesizes these. Today we're concerned with masculinity and femininity in the spiritual life.